Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place.
Go for it.
All righty. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we're showing the rhythm section some love today. We got one of the finest session basses in Nashville with us. We're here with Luis Espaillat. He's a multifaceted bassist and musician whose career has spanned many genres and taken him around the world. And we'll talk about a bunch of stuff today. And he really has done a lot of cool stuff. His unique sound can be heard in all forms of media, from shows on network television such as Smallville, Boston Public, King of the Hill, Major Motion. This is because he told me that he likes my voice, that now I can't speak. Major Motion Pictures, including SWAT, American Pie 3, and even video games, including Need for Speed, Hot Pursuit 2, and Project Gotham Racing. In the studio, Luis can be heard in various genres, from country legends like Michael Martin Murphy to contemporary country, Juno Award nominees Autumn Hill to the Billboard Top 20 hard rock sounds of Eve to Adam. His sense and respect for the art of the song itself has made him an in-demand player for many songwriters and producers, not only in Nashville, but also in Los Angeles and New York City. On the stage, Luis has performed with country stars Trace Adkins, Chris Carmack, Jamie O'Neill, Jimmy Wayne, Lindsay L., Terry Clark, Pam Tillis, and James Otto. Rockers such as Tantric and Bo Bice, progressive instrumentalists like Johnny Hyland, and even artists that defy normal conventions such as country rapper Colt Ford, just to name a few. He's a graduate of Berklee College of Music, and he also conducts clinics and master classes on the world of studio recording, touring, and of course, playing bass. Luis lives in Nashville, Tennessee with his wife, three children, and a dog, and he pronounces words better than any human being I've ever interviewed. So if you need a voiceover, I would also say he is your man. Hey, man, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, man, you're welcome. I'll tell you a quick story about Johnny Hyland. I know you've played with him. So I interviewed Johnny. We had a really nice conversation after the call, and he was like all excited, and he goes, Craig, I see you play guitar. I said, well, I'm not going to sit here and tell Johnny Hyland I play guitar. I have guitars and I play them, you know? And he says, man, let's play guitar together sometime. And I'm like, you know, Johnny, on the one hand, like, that's the most wonderful, like, dream I could imagine. On the other hand, there's no way I'm playing guitar with you. You're Johnny Hyland. I just can't do that. How about you play? I'll watch, and you know, we can have a virtual beer or something like that. But no way. But anyway, that was my Johnny Hyland story.
That's great.
So
yeah, Johnny's a nice guy. I mean, he's the kind of guy who's like, yeah, let's jam. I mean, and then you realize his talent level when he actually starts to play, and you're just like, I'm gonna quit now.
I know this. I'm like, and he's like, because he's coming down here to do some recording. Mm-hmm. And he'll be in St. Pete, and he goes, let's hang out. I'm like, I will hang out. Let's go have a cigar, man. But we're not playing music together, man. I just can't do that. Anyway, man, you've got a really, you know, we're talking before the call, and your career and your application of your skills as a bass player is really diverse. I mean, tremendously diverse. Like, you, for example, you do a lot of licensing work. And for the listeners, when I say licensing work, I mean movies, television, and video games. And I cut down a lot of the projects that Luis has worked on because we would just never finish. But how'd you get into doing that stuff?
Well, initially, it wasn't by design. I didn't plan it. I was grateful to be part of it, but it started with a band that I was part of on Atlantic Records a number of years ago called Hot Action Cop. And we were on the Lava division of Atlantic Records. And since they were tied in with a lot of with New Line Cinema specifically, but with some other Warner Brothers Television, some other media outlets, that was kind of part of the deal. They're, once they heard a song off the record, they're like, this is a cool song. To further promote it, you know, as the single, let's place it in a movie or television or what have you not. And sure enough, the lead off single of that first record that I played on wound up being in that song alone. I think three of the TV shows that are on that list that I did are from that song alone.
Wow.
Yeah. About another three major motion pictures, same deal. That song's on there. And
holy smokes, that's great.
Yeah. And the first video game that you mentioned, Project Gotham, or no, sorry, the first one, the Need for Speed Hot Pursuit 2, had, I think, two or three of our songs, and that was definitely one of them. So, I mean, right out of the gate, I didn't have to do anything. I mean, it was great. it was just, I just reap the benefits. They're just like, hey, we're going to go place this just to let you know. I'm like, okay, sure.
Wow.
And I still reap the benefits for that to this day, which is awesome. But that's how it started. And then a lot of times, you know, there's another record I cut for a band called Eyed, again, about 10 years ago, that did okay in Japan. But they got placed on Greek, which was a CW show, I think. It was a college show, Greek, you know, like fraternity.
Fraternities, yeah. And
same deal, again, where, like, I didn't know until they're like, hey, by the way, it's going to be on this. Okay, cool. As far as trying to pursue it myself, I really can't take any credit. I haven't done a lot of that. It's been by happenstance. But the kind of stuff that I've done where it's been directly for that source of media has been doing jingles. So in other words, I've played on sessions for stuff for Zaxby's and Ford Trucks and that kind of thing. And that's more of the like, okay, let me go hunt that down. You need somebody to plan your jingles. I'm your guy too. And sure enough, I got some of that work. But as far as like doing the heavy lifting, I really can't take credit for it. I was just another cog in the wheel, just the player on it. But it's great to have, and it's great to have as another, you know, part of your resume, if you will.
Let me ask you something. How would you, if you wanted to do more jingle work, is there like, you know, 2 or 3 or 10 companies that are primarily responsible, you know, companies that are looking to advertise go to those guys and for music, or how does that work? How does that industry work?
Well, absolutely there is. And that's the company or the individual in particular that I did both the Zaxby's and the Ford truck commercials that I mentioned is one guy that is an artist himself, and he's produced some records that I've played on, but his bread and butter is the jingle work because he's an LA guy and he still has those accounts. So there's certain individuals and or companies that kind of that's their gig. You know, that's what they do. We have another guy who's a buddy of mine who I've done some gigs. He's a great guitar player, but he's also from LA, and the bulk of his work was, it still is, doing what do you call it, like trailer music. So specifically him and his partner would do create a sample library or create a cue library for them to use in trailers, movie trailers. Mm. So, you know, that dun, dun, dun stuff, you know, that's him. And, you know, he's his name is Michael Elsner, if you look him up.
I just spoke to him last week.
Oh, well, there you go. So, Mike, so that's yeah. That's Michael. And yeah. Michael's, you know, we're buds, and we just did, actually, he produced a record that just came out that he had me and Rich Redmond on drums play. And that was fun because we knocked it out in a day and had a blast doing it. But he's the kind of guy where he's done a lot of session work in the past and is known for that and has done all this other licensing work. But he's like, well, that's great. I'm doing all this. But, hey, if you hear of a live gig, I'll take it just so I can diversify a little more because it's like I don't want to be just this one guy.
Yeah.
Even though
is that from a creative standpoint? He doesn't want to be that one guy or and I'm not saying this that you know his motivations, or is that financially because he doesn't want to be, because it would seem like if he's doing is that you'd be making a good living.
Yeah, no, I think he does. And not that I've gone to details. We've spoken about it because, you know, he's asked me about the things that I do that he hasn't been able to do and vice versa.
Gotcha.
But I think his motivation is more creative than anything else because financially, if he's worried about the money, I think he's like, well, I'll just get more of this work. And he has the connection to work towards that. If that was his motivation, I think it really is just to diversify. I think he's just itching to, and he does. He probably told you he went with an artist to China for a while and played.
We've just been playing phone tag. We've been playing phone tag, yeah.
Okay, so when you talk to him, he'll tell you about it. He's gone a few times in the last couple of years, like multiple trips to China, just to have the opportunity to play live with this artist that does well in China. Obviously, it's a good gig, but for his motivation is like, I just got to get out and play. You know, I don't want to be in cooped up all day long. I want to get out and do some gigs. And that's how we met. We actually played Chris Nix, who you've interviewed before, heads up the Drummer's Jam and the Loud Jams things, which I do. I've been doing those since day one as well. And that's how I met Michael initially, was we were paired up on.
Oh, he used to be in Nashville.
What's that now? Sorry?
He used to be in Nashville.
Michael Elsner?
Yeah.
He still is in Nashville. Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. I thought he's in L.A. That's enough.
He was in L.A. He might, I mean, unless he's moved, I'll text him. Did you move? No, because I went to his house not too long ago, okay. So he's still there. I hope it's the same guy. It might be a different guy.
No, it's got to be the same guy because he's – but he's this guy I was talking to was in L.A. That's really weird.
Okay, gotcha. Maybe he still keeps the place over there. Like I said, I just know him here and there. He's a good dude. But we got paired up. I mean, that's how we met was just, hey, you know, you guys going to play on this song or whatever? We'll jam and have a good time. And then we just hit it off from there on out. So that's, you know, that kind of thing with licensing and those avenues. Yeah, there's people that do that specifically as their job. And there's companies that do just that. So, yeah, there's definitely, I mean, you can, in this business, you can get as specific as you want and you can get as diverse as you want.
Right.
I just choose to be diverse because it does, as an independent contractor, which is what most of us are as hired musicians, it makes sense to diversify. It's like diversifying your portfolio.
Absolutely.
You know, in a financial sense, it makes a lot of sense. But also, for me personally, there's a creative reward to switch gears. I love doing that. And I've already done it. I did, like this week alone, I finished up a couple dates with Trace Adkins this past weekend. So we got home on Monday.
Very cool.
And then I jumped right into rehearsals for the show coming up tonight with Dixie Horsepower. And then I played Wednesday night. I played at the Music City Roots Show, which is a broadcast live, both audio and video, kind of Opry style that Jim Lauderdale hosts. And I got asked to play as a special guest with a great songwriter comedian I worked with years ago named Greg Hall, who does a lot of work now more as a stand-up comic, but he's a songwriter at heart. And he'd asked me, he's like, would you be interested in playing the Al Stewart song, You're the Cat, from 1977? I'm like, okay, but why? He's like, well, the guy who played sax on the original track is going to get up and play with us.
Oh, very cool. That's a great, memorable sax solo.
Yeah, it's memorable. And that guy, like, I chatted with him over dinner. And I'm like, it's one of those moments you realize who he's played with. He's played on all the Rod Stewart records. He's played on Eagles records. He's played on Rolling Stones records. I mean, he's
What's his name?
His name is Phil Kenzie. No, if you look him up, you'll see Phil Kenzie. But couldn't have been nicer, sweeter, older British gentleman who lives that's far away.
You know what? The reason I ask is I'm wondering if he's played with Pink Floyd.
It's very possible. I don't know.
I don't think his name is Phil Kenzie. That's why I shook my head. But anyway, that's really cool.
Yeah, his resume is legendary. It's one of those, like, you go down the rabbit hole and you, like, you played on. I even made a crack. Like, we were talking and somebody's picking his brain about give me an Eagles story. You played on that live Eagles 80 record that you even mentioned by name on the record. And I was making a crack about Rod Stewart because he said he played on some stuff. And I talked to him about the song Hot Legs. Because we were talking about the drummer and Carmine Appice.
Yeah.
And I kind of casually just looked and was like, let me guess, you probably played on that. And he went, actually, I did. I'm like, forget it. I you win. Wow. But anyways, the point of the story is that I got to play with him. And that's one night of my life. And the next night I switch hats and I do traditional country. And then I'll do a full out rock gig. And then I'll, you know, the next day I'll be doing a pop session. So I love that change up.
Yeah.
That just drives me.
So it keeps you fresh creatively, keeps you interested in what you're doing. And then financially you're diversifying your career. So you're not all your eggs in one basket. So it's just a win all around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of people that are, choose to not diversify, and that's fine. I mean, that's a choice thing. They just like to kind of stick to it. And that's fine. It's just one of those things where I've never done that before, per se. I mean, other than like when I was a couple times where I've toured with rock bands or whatever, like the aforementioned Hot Action Cop. I mean, I was gone for an entire year with them. I didn't have time to do anything else because it was promoting the record. And it was on that rock and roll schedule of we're going to tour the world. We've got so basically you're just coming home to – you're home for 48 hours because we're on our way to the West Coast or something.
Were you like the opening act or were you the headlining act when you were there?
With them, it varied. A lot of times when we first started, we were opening obviously for a lot of bands. But then when the single started to pick up some steam and the placement was starting to get known, we would headline clubs.
Very cool.
What we had, there was a club in Knoxville, Tennessee called Alley Cats or Blue Cats. Sorry, Alley Cats is in Virginia. Blue Cats in Knoxville. And the first time we played there, we played opening up for a band called Trapped that had that song Headstrong on the radio, modern rock song. And so they headline, and the that was at the beginning of the year that we toured. At the end of the year, it reversed. We wound up headlining.
Oh, so that cool.
That was satisfying. Now, granted, that's just a very small sliver of the big pie, so to speak. So, you know, you get to headline one day, and the next day, you know, nope, go take out the trash, you know.
Yeah, but that's, in many ways, sometimes that's how owning a small business is.
Mm-hmm.
For in a lot of different industries, you know, it's you have good times and, you know, not so good times. It's just the reality of it. One sure. question I want to ask you is you were mentioning your friends with the drummer. Is that more of a normal thing where bass and drum guys tend to be buddies and then guitarists are buddies with other guitarists, it seems like?
That's a pretty good observation, actually. Yeah, guitarists, they're just full of themselves. No, I'm kidding. they're all going to like, especially like, they'll shoot me. But yeah, I find, well, the thing with me is, yeah, there is that relationship between the bass and drums. That's a unique relationship and a necessary one. And that can extend to the personal side. And I mean, I've done gigs where on the personal level, me and the drummer don't quite click.
Hmm.
And we've played just fine, and it's been good. And that's not in a bad way. Not that we were at each other's throats.
You just can't get along with everybody. That's not realistic.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And no matter how hard you try to be like a nice guy, whatever, you can't please everybody.
Plus, you're just dropped in this situation. When in reality, it's random that you will get along with someone. I mean, it's like, you know, like people watch that show, The Housewives, and I didn't know this, but my wife told me that they don't know each other before. They're just all dropped there. Because I always thought, man, how do these women... They're such bitches, don't they? I thought they're supposed to be friends. She goes, no, they don't know each other. I was like, oh, so it's the same thing like in a band when you're like for session stuff or whatever.
Yeah, well, both sessions and even live stuff too. But and sometimes, you know, that's why I like to ask when I get called for a session or even a live random live gig. I'm like, who else is on it? Just because I like to know, and especially I've been very, very, very privileged to work with. I mean, in the drum department, I've not been lacking, but I'll just put it to that way. Very, 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 very rarely have I ever played with a drummer and go, you know, it's always been like, oh, thank God, you know. But yeah, I mean, I'm friends with a lot of drummers, even more so. I've got a lot of bass player friends.
Yeah.
But by sheer numbers, I probably have more drummer friends because we're going to be on gigs together and stuff. And I really do believe that. But also, I'm kind of a drum aficionado. Like, obviously, I don't play drums, and I don't pretend to. But, you know, even so, I'm the guy. I remember I was out when I was touring with Jimmy Wayne. We were the opening act for Brad Paisley for a whole summer a few years ago. And the drummer and I were buddies before. And actually, that drummer is now playing in the Trace Atkins camp with me. So
that's cool.
But even he'll tell you that we'd be on a fly date. So we're on the plane and he'd have like a copy of Modern Drummer. And I'd be like, hey, when you're done, can I read that? You know, I like that stuff.
It's just your thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I like drummers. And so I always ask, you know, like, hey, what do you use? And I like to, I'm fascinated by, you know, different makes of drums and the song, you know, how they get their sounds and how they play. Because obviously with instruments, it's not just the makeup of the instrument, but it's the approach and how you're either hitting it or playing it. Really is the change of the sound.
Yes.
So I'm always picking brains of drummers like that really worked for them. So what are they using that works for them? You know, that's the thing I like. But yeah, I like to be friends with drummers, and I'm friends with a lot of them, and I'm very grateful to be so.
Yeah, it would seem more of a natural bent because you're all a team, but you two are a team for sure.
Yeah.
You know, you're driving the bus, so to speak. So that would make a lot of sense.
I had that conversation not too long ago with Trace's band leader about that relationship, because he was like, it begins and ends with the bass and drums. And while I do believe that, I don't think that's the be all end all. I think when we're talking about a good sense of timing and feel and cohesion with the band, I think everybody's responsible. I think in a good situation, the drummer's like your metronome. He sets the precedence.
Right.
And bass is like the bridge between the drums and the other instruments as well, because we have to make sure that we're locked, but we're also harmonically taking care of a lot of stuff. So, I mean, that's that relationship still, regardless of where it's in the grand scheme of things, is super important.
I saw this, I don't know if you saw it, like some meme on Facebook. Is that how you pronounce it? Meme?
I think so. Meme?
No, I think it's a meme. I don't know. I'm just like old when it comes to that stuff, but it was a drummer talking to the band leader, and he goes, all right, do you want to play ahead of the beat or behind the beat? You know, because yeah. everybody's always like, you know, bitching about their you're ahead or you're behind. It was kind of funny.
Exactly.
How did you get – you do a lot of work outside of Nashville, New York and L.A., and I was curious how you got those gigs, because most people are not doing that, that are studio guys, session guys in Nashville. They're only in Nashville. And what are the differences between, you know, New York, L.A., and Nashville, both in terms of the vibe and in terms of, like, the execution, like how songs are assembled and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that over the last handful of years has changed all around, I think. When I started, when I got to town here in Nashville, I had enough of the people that I knew from before, aka the ones I went to college with, who are both in New York and LA. So that's how I was able to tie into those, I don't want to say markets, but I got work that wasn't Nashville based.
So you got work from guys you went to Berkeley with that were out there and called on you.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, sure did.
Wow, that's man, that's your tuition dollars at work. That's awesome.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the beauties of Berkeley, because as a school, obviously, like with any other institution, there's a lot of pluses and minuses, and people have a lot of criticism to offer up about Berkeley. My experience was good, and it wasn't because of the academia side of it. Obviously, that was great. I learned a lot, and you know, I still hold my teachers on a pedestal. They you know, because they are not just teaching the academic side, but they also play and have had careers themselves and continue to have careers. And their approaches are different. So one teacher is going to be very different than the other one. But the best part of Berkeley beyond that for me was what taught me the lessons that I use to this day in the business, which is interacting with other musicians. Mm. And not only playing, but the communications. And like to this day where, you know, hey, man, I really want to have you on this session, blah, blah, blah. And how do you ask the guy? We were doing that at Berkeley. You know, you're knocking on your dorm room, whatever, dude, can you do a session for me, blah, 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 quid pro quo, all that stuff. So it was the part of Berkeley was being able to interact with so many different people from all over the world. I mean, there's several, not even several, like most of the world is represented at Berkeley.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, I mean, I would, you know, one day I'd play free jazz in a jam room with a sax player from Germany. And I remember that guy specifically because he was always very critical. Like I'd do something and I thought it was a jam, but he would kind of stop and in that German accent says, "This is not the way Mingus would play it." And I'm like, yeah, I'm not Charles Mingus. Okay. I thought it was a jam. But he was that guy.
No, but Germans, their cultures, they're brutally direct. Like brutally direct, man. I like because it's like I don't want to waste my time, you know. But,
oh yeah, they're pretty efficient. They're just like kind of to the point, you know. There's like, you know where you stand with them, you know. That's the thing. But you know, or like you know, the next night it'd be I don't know, we'd do some Nirvana or something. Or I remember the first recital show that I got hired, quote unquote, outside of my group of people to play was a tribute to The Cure.
Oh, that's cool.
Like it's like, dude, can you come and play some Cure? Are you familiar with it?
So you're playing Mingus one day and you're playing The Cure the next day. That is really cool. That's really good training, man.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's really valuable.
And those relationships continue to this day. I mean, my main buddy in LA, I've got a few LA buddies, obviously, but the best man for my wedding, it was the guy who's an LA cat who I went to Berkeley with, and I was the best man at his wedding. And we're the godparents of each other's kids, and we're still buddies, even though we live on completely other sides of the country. And wow. He's gotten me work. I mean, he got me, heck, even when he wasn't really doing a lot himself, he still like got friends with a few writers, and I happen to be out there, and he's like, bring your bass, man. I got a session for you. I'm like, sweet.
Wow, that's so awesome.
I, you know, went to some dude's home studio in the Hollywood Hills and was cutting tracks, and it was killer, you know? And even more recently, talking about sessions out there, I did a record on Sony for a band called Eve to Adam, that one I mentioned earlier, that actually charted well. We did half of that record out in LA at NRG Studios. And, you know, that was another one of those like, wow, I'm doing another record in LA at a pretty sizable place like NRG. So it was killer.
I see your dog in the background making a guest appearance, man.
Scott, what are you doing? Where are you going? Mommy's not home yet.
He looks confused, man.
Well, normally what happens is because I had three dogs up until recently, two of them unfortunately passed away.
Man, I'm sorry. That's really – I hate – yes. Yeah, it's devastating.
Well, it's tough because we had both of those dogs for, 10, 11, 12, 13, close to 15 years, one of them.
Yeah.
So Scout here is the old man, the remainder. So he, having the other two dogs gone, he doesn't like to be left alone.
Yeah.
So even if I'm here in my office working or even just sitting here doing something like this, he doesn't want to be alone. So I had to set up his little, there's a nest back there.
Yeah, I see it.
I know. So long as he's in the room with me, he's okay. Otherwise, he'll freak out.
I hear you. Yeah, I have an old dog too. She's kind of the same.
Anxiety. Yep.
One question is, New York versus Nashville versus LA. What's the difference in the vibe?
Oh, right. We're talking about that. The vibe. Well, it's very different, and even that answer has changed over the years. Where, in the last batch of years, it seemed like the New York session scene dried up the first, as far as like where sessions, the money's not there anymore. There's not as much work to be had in those world. There still is, but not nearly as much as there used to be. If you talk to anybody who's like one generation ahead of me, they'll tell you. And New York seemed to be the first one to go. I mean, there's still work to be had,
interesting,
but not nearly amount. And then LA is the next one. Although there's a lot of recording, but a lot of soundtrack work and commercial work there. There's still records being cut there, but the vibe being different from here is that here in Nashville, it still seems to be the holdout where we still have a group of musicians in the same room to cut the record.
Right.
In LA, it seems like one piece at a time. They have the studios. They do cut a lot of bands on the floor together, but not nearly as much. And I hear this from dudes that are LA cats, first and foremost, and they say, man, not anymore. 9 times out of 10, Lee Sklar, legendary session player.
Right.
Even I heard an interview with him recently. He's like, man, 80% of my work, I go to some dude's house and plug in and play to pre-recorded something or other.
So everybody's going to mobile home studios.
Exactly. It's just cost effective and the technology is there. But as any of those guys will tell you, it's a different vibe. Especially in the bass and drums department where – I love to play with a drummer, first of all, that I've played with before, because we can kind of read each other and go places.
Yeah.
But even so, being in the room, and I love having that interaction because I've got a visual on them. And a lot of times, especially where it's a drummer I've never played with before, it's like in poker where people have tells. Drummers have physical tells.
Interesting.
And you see him do something like a twitch of a shoulder. He's like, oh, he's about to do a fill or something. So I know to be prepared to do something with them.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. That's very cool.
And I've had one guy in particular tell, man, how did you know I was going to do that? I'm like, dude, your shoulder dropped or something. So I love that interaction. And when you have all these people on the floor, the word vibe, we're vibing off each other. We see something. Or even that, if we're doing something live and we want to kind of go off the rails a bit, you know how it is on stage. You kind of give somebody a look like, we're going to do something here. And to heads up. You can do that on tape too, or recorded, and have that vibe. And it really does translate. I've done some great records where it's been piecemeal, but I still enjoy, I get fulfillment with playing with all the players on the floor. And that's how the vibe differs here. There's more of that than there is LA, even though there's still some of that in LA and New York very much so as well. So, well, the vibe with the two of the things, I had to think about this myself too. Really the answer to the question is the vibe. It depends on who you're working with. It doesn't matter where you're working with. And that is very true nowadays because since we do a lot of stuff remotely. So, I mean, a lot of times you might do a record and I'm here in Nashville, the drummer's in LA, the guitar player's in Austin, Texas, the singer's in New York or Germany or something, that it really depends on who's running, who's steering the ship as to the vibe of the session. The generalization that I gave you is changing. It's like there's not as many, them doing things piecemeal in LA is just what I've experienced where, maybe you and the drummer, like the Eve Tatum record was a good example where me and the drummer laid the parts down first by ourselves with nothing, with like maybe a guide vocal, like a scratch vocal. And then the guitar player overdubbed his stuff at another studio. And I think at the producer's home studio in Malibu, and then we this and that or whatever. So I've experienced more of that where it's more pieced. And some people do work that way here, But when I get called for a full tracking session, it usually means everybody's on the floor together.
And in New York, it's just faded totally.
Pretty much, especially, well, in regards to me, I know there's other work there and I've got friends out there. I haven't done anything New York based in a long time. But even then, it was kind of also piecemealed even then. And now it just seems like, you know, studios died down. And there's a few, obviously, upper echelon guys that still work in that scene, but not nearly as much as they did back in, like, say, the 70s, you know, where New York, the session scene was hopping.
You're originally from Orlando, correct?
No, I actually grew up in Sebring, Florida.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize. I thought you were from Orlando.
Gotcha.
What was growing up like? Like, you have a big family or?
I had, I'm the oldest of a few different siblings. I'll explain that. So from my mom and dad, I'm the eldest. Then I have a sister who's 7 years younger than I am and a brother who's 10 years younger than I am.
Oh, wow.
And then when my parents split up and got remarried, they each had a daughter on each side. So I have another two sisters.
Much younger.
That are my youngest sister, two is from my mom's side. My mom and my mom's divorced again, but her second husband. And she is 23, I want to say. I feel bad I should know this, and she's going to shoot me for not knowing that. So they're younger. I mean, at a decent clip, not horribly younger, but younger enough. And so growing up, even though there was a bit of a gap between me and my next sibling by 7 years, we had some time together in the house, the first three kids. But a lot of their formidable years, I was already gone to college.
Yeah.
The age gap. So certain things I didn't get to experience and vice versa.
Do you think – I had a conversation with a guitar player recently about this. And if you don't want to talk about it, just let me know. Do you think like watching your folks get a divorce influenced you either – like gave you some trepidation or just influenced your own thoughts on what you want and don't want out of a marriage?
Yes, I think so. I think I'd be lying to say no, obviously, but I mean, that's life and that's being a parent and being the next generation is that your hope is to pass on to your kids to not repeat mistakes.
Yeah. For sure.
You know, and not to say that's not a mistake. It's just kind of maybe not repeating mistakes is not a good word, but it would be more like hopefully they don't suffer as many hardships as you had.
Right.
You know, so obviously that's a difficult hardship. You know.
Yeah. Divorce sure.
Is hard on everybody. Obviously, the people that that are going through it, but then the kids too. And I experienced divorce when I was just shy of my 10th birthday.
Oh wow! So that's tough for that to happen. Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's a tough thing. So, yeah, I mean, that's obviously I'd be lying to say it's influenced me. But at the same token, it's not like I think about it consciously. I don't think about like, OK, well, they did this, so I'm not going to do that. I don't think of it that way.
Interesting. Yeah. Sorry, we're having some canine difficulties.
Oh yeah, that's all right. Keep talking. I can hear you. I'm just kind of trying to tuck him into his bed so he would be quiet.
How did you get exposed to music? You know, how did that all come about?
Well, that was early age because even though my family weren't in music or were not musicians themselves by trait, they appreciated music and were music lovers. On both sides, my dad and my mom. My mom was very artistic and still is to this day. She's a very good visual artist. She's a great painter and that kind of thing. And my father studied voice, you know, a little bit like in school. He said he was in the choir and he'd done those kind of things. So he knew it was up. But so I was exposed to music early on, you know, obviously through them, whatever they had around the house, which varied. And it did include some Latino music as well. Especially younger before the divorce, but then it also had whatever's on the radio. It was popular at the time. Movie soundtracks were big. I was a big fan of that out of the gate. And my dad was a big classical fan, so he saw, you know, there's a connection there. So, he bought me, like, you know, soundtracks to anything John Williams, like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, that kind of stuff. And so that was like, I almost consider him like a musical influence on me. I learned certain things about phrasing, the way he phrases certain things, or thematic development, which he's very much that kind of a composer that is theme-based. So he has an overall arcing theme of the movie, whatever you're watching, but then even with the individual characters, they have their own theme, and how he can shift the mood with the same sequence of notes, maybe making it in a parallel minor or something like that. But that's how I got into music early on, and my mom was always, since I was the firstborn, she was the one pushing to go, well, he's going to do some art stuff too to make me well-rounded. So we'll do piano lessons together. We'll take art classes together, and we did. And where I kind of stuck with piano a bit, she didn't stick with as much and was a much better visual artist than I was. Like I can barely draw stick figures, and she makes these beautiful scenic paintings. And thusly, I stuck with it and always enjoyed it. Always had a thing for it. You know, I started piano lessons at, I think it was 5 or 6 years old.
Well, that's really young.
And then, so I, you know, and it was very, you know, it's basic stuff. I mean, it's just, it's geared towards that age group, what you're trying to learn. But that gave me a head start when I got to start school band in middle school, fifth grade. I already knew the notes on the treble clef and the bass clef from piano. So I could automatically, you know, kind of translate those skills to school band and not learning from scratch. So school band obviously came about, and just even then I was already driven during middle school to like, I really like this. I'd like to entertain the possibility of this being my livelihood.
Wow. At such a young age.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh yeah. And I wasn't even, and not necessarily as a bass player or as a session guy or as a road guy or as whatever. It was just, well, what is there to do? I just want to play music. Does that mean play with the symphony orchestra? Does that mean teach, you know, like be a band director? Does it mean this? And that's all true. It's all yes. Those are all valid answers. I just didn't know for me personally what that was going to be yet. And even then I knew that. I said, well, I want to do something. I just didn't know what it is yet. And I continued into high school with school band and playing different instruments. And because I had taken piano lessons, and about that time, well, the cool thing was to get into a rock band, you know?
Of course.
Because I started like, well, hey, I can get a rock band. I can get chicks.
Girl, so, right.
So I got – but I was also starting to get interested in that side of things. This is where what I had – the mutual musical taste that my parents and I had started to deviate a little bit, because I was finding my own. It wasn't a bad thing. It was just, okay, now I'm starting to hear things from my peers.
Oh,
Me, and I'm starting to discover different bands and different musical things, and So I you know, I asked my dad, like, I wanted to get like a synth, you know, to play, because that's the one thing I'm like, well, what's the one instrument I can play that I can translate to a band? Keyboards. All right, let's start that. And because of that, all of a sudden I got bit by the electronic music bug early on too, because it was just, I was fascinated. Like, I started to read about it and like, oh, so you mean this has been around since the 50s and the 60s, you know? And I say that, and I have a analog synth right here, you know, I use for synth bass, because I'm still fascinated by being able to twiddle knobs and change, you know, here's a switch, put an LFO in there, make a different sound and all that stuff. But the other thing that started to fascinate me sonically was the bass around that time as well.
Not guitar.
No, not guitar at all. I like guitar. I appreciate guitar. And I could, you know, especially some of my buddies who were playing guitar already, you know, so, well, there's Eddie Van Halen and whatever. And even at this point, like, this is like, Eddie Van Halen is one generation before me, but he's still an influence to this day. Even people are like, well, it's Eddie Van Halen, you know? But they're into guitar players and guitar, but I just sonically was just digging what the bass was doing. And it's something as simple as pounding eighth notes, just doom, 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 doom. I love the sound of that. I was just like drawn, like, and so from my, you know, musical brain, I was starting to think, well, okay, so a bass has 4 strings. And if I know the 4 strings and it's only chromatic all the way up, how hard could it be?
Especially coming off keyboards.
Yeah. Well, even keyboards, you look at the keys, like logically you're looking at a keyboard, it's chromatic all the way up. You just have to think of the frets as the next key up. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, as long as you know the open strings and that's your starting point, you go from there. So to me, it was like, well, how hard could it be? Plus, I love the sound of it. So I think that Christmas, this was even early high school, I was starting to ask my parents about getting a bass, and they're like, just bought you a synthesizer, what gives? So finally for Christmas, they actually gave me money, and they didn't buy me a bass. They just gave me money, and they're like, well, use this however you want to use it. And I think they knew I'm going to go buy a bass, and it was just enough, I think, to buy a really inexpensive bass, which was perfect. And
yeah.
So I was already like, oh, this is great. And so I started to pick it up from there. And then all of a sudden, it just felt comfortable in my hands. That thing was just like a natural extension of who I am. And so I started to obviously invest more time into it, play with it more, and starting to realize, oh, it's not as easy as you think. Mm. There's a lot more to it, because even though what makes an instrument, every musician can say, oh, I know how it works, but it's also the finesse and the delivery of it all.
Yeah.
The attack, the approach, how do you do it? Well, a bass should do this and should not do this, or let me try this. But the bass became a natural extension. I really got into bass players, and I really got fascinated with making records and playing with other people, and I just wanted to do that. And obviously, the rock and roll thing was a natural desire from a very base instinct of, like, obviously, hey, it's a good social thing.
Yeah.
Whether it's also because it gives me an opportunity to play with a band and be friends with people. You know, it's like, here's your gang of people. You get to be in a gang of people, but also, and the opposite sex is noticing.
And you get to get girls.
I know. That was the thing. I was like, this is awesome. There's girls are looking at me now because I, and it's not anything. I was playing basic stuff, but it didn't matter.
Right.
Case in point, my son, I have, you know, I have three kids and two are adopted. So I have older kids, not, you know, even though, like, you know, people like, well, are you old enough to have kids that age? I'm like, I guess so. But my son, my technically middle kid, had his first band recital, his first rock band recital yesterday.
That's cool. And how old is, and what grade is
he's 13. He's 7th grade, 13, and he started a school band in 5th grade and wanted to be a drummer. Now, when I was getting in there, everybody wanted to be a drummer because it was the cool thing to do.
Mm.
And I remember my band director, even when I was in 5th grade, going like, don't everybody pick drums, and here's why. So here comes, you know, now the next generation, my son going, I want to be a drummer, and I'm starting to act like a band director. I'm like, are you sure about this? I mean, you might want to think about it. That afternoon, I got an email from the band director going like, you know what? I think he's going to do well. He should be a drummer.
Oh,
he's
cool.
Really got the mindset, like, it's not just the cool factor. He really likes to do it.
Good.
So yesterday was the first time I saw him behind a drum kit. And he played, and I almost saw the moment. Scout, really? I saw the moment that he got bit by the bug. I got it on video too, where I'm like, all of a sudden that grin where you just start playing and he just went, because everybody's looking at him. I'm like, oh, that's it. It's over.
So now you think he'll be pretty committed to playing?
I think so. We'll see how it happens. Obviously, it's early, but, you know, he seems committed enough and has the, you know, he wants to do something with it. My wife couldn't make it because she was stuck at work.
Hmm.
So I'm texting her and showing her pictures or whatever, and I just texted her crap. He's a drummer, you know, because not only he's 13 and
how old are your other kids?
Oh, my daughter, his sister is 20 now.
Okay.
We adopted him 7 years ago.
Okay.
And, my youngest from the old fashioned way is 3.
Oh, wow. That's a big spread. 20, yeah. 13 and 3. Wow.
Well, because we adopted the other kids.
No, I get young. It. Right.
So there's that. He got bitten by the bug. And not only that, the girl thing already happened too, because literally, as soon as he was done there and he's behind the kit, there is literally, I'm just center stage watching him in the crowd. There's 5 girls about his age, like to my right.
Nice.
And sees them. And he's from the drum kit waving. Already. I'm like, oh boy, here we go. We're screwed. He's a drummer.
Yeah, but that's 13. That's about the normal age.
Exactly. That's right. But it's just kind of like, you know, now being the parent, I'm like, oh, great.
Your youngest, is that a boy or girl?
It's a boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're not going to.
My youngest is a boy.
Deal with
3.5 years old.
The whole dating thing, although you probably had to deal with it with your daughter.
Yeah, a little bit. My daughter, I dealt with a little. Well, it's weird because I almost jumped into it because when we adopted her, she was 13 already. Because
that must have been really tough. Taiwan.
Yeah, and they're Taiwanese, and they're the good thing is they're blood relatives. They're brother and sister.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see her on tomorrow, actually. I'm going to have lunch with her because she doesn't live in the house anymore. She moved out, but she's close by.
Right.
We'll see her tomorrow. And so I got a little taste of that. Very – kind of almost jumped into it because, like I said, 13 and then 14, 15, 16, et cetera. So we did experience that a little bit, and that's interesting. And
I would bet Asian cultures, though, are much more reserved – all around with stuff like that included than, you know, American culture.
Right. Well, in a lot of regards, you're correct.
Yeah.
In some regards, no, they're just like every other kid. It's amazing because obviously that question comes out a lot about how the cultural differences are with them since they grew up. They've had that part of their life. They remember it. You're right in some regards, but I think they're also a product of their environment. So when they come here, they just acclimate.
Right.
And honestly, a teenage girl is a teenage girl is a teenage girl, no matter what country you're
Dude,
in.
Dude, it is literally the toughest thing I've had to do, steal my daughter.
Yeah, exactly. You've done it.
I mean, literally. And she's pretty much through it now. She's almost 18, but like,
okay.
It was really dicey, man. Honestly, it was.
Oh, yeah.
You learn a lot about patience and.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, for me anyway, you can't react with a girl like you do with a boy.
Right.
That was a big lesson. I didn't grow up with any women or sisters or anything, so it was like, oh. So it was, anyway.
Learning experience. It's all right. I got my son now I got to deal with now with puberty and everything. And my wife's like, your department, you can handle this one.
Yeah, but,
like,
but it's good that he's in music.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really good. So he's got that interest and, you know.
Yeah,
you know, you probably have to keep your eye on them. Like, this all kids, same thing with drugs and stuff like that. But
well, sure, and that's only normal. I mean, we as parents, we do the best we can. Yeah. But again, one of those things where we're only part of the equation. The rest of the environment is the other part.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and I feel grateful that at their core, all my kids have really great hearts. So I'm not really worried about them going off the deep end too much.
Yeah.
At least right now. So we'll see.
Who are your biggest influences playing-wise as a bassist?
That's a tough one. And the reason it's a tough one, I mean, I know it's a logical question, but much like there's so many different styles that I gravitate towards naturally that I like, just out of sheer desire, not just, well, that's what I do, it's desire. It's the same thing with bass influences. You know, one of the first guys that actually fascinated me with bass just because of the facility was Geddy Lee.
Okay.
Just because of, you know, not only because of what, you know, what I watched him do, like, okay, he's going to sing lead, play bass, play keys and sometimes all at the same time, you know, that was a unique thing. I never seen anybody do that before. So I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And I'm like, I play keys too. So maybe I could do that too. And I have, but also some of his lines that he did were very frenetic, very, you know, obviously it's all in context. Some of that stuff is just not appropriate in other styles. Like, I'd never play some of those licks on this gig or that gig, but it was fascinating when he had that really pointy tone, some of the like mid 80s records that he did, but you had those very, he was able to squeeze in these really fast lines and make it work in a musical context.
So very much so.
It was a lot of like, wow, that's a lot of notes, but it didn't feel like it was completely out of place. You know, it's like, okay, you're just playing for show off. No, that made sense.
No. I would say he's not a show off. Yeah, he's very tasteful. It's kind of like, I don't know if you like this guy, John Entwistle.
Oh, love John Entwistle. I mean,
talk about a fast guy, but it was all in context, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, all in context with that guy. And yeah, he's the guy who, again, you listen to My Generation and those little bass breaks, you know, it's just like, you know, it makes sense. All you don't go like, oh, there's a show off bass player doing a bass solo. You go like, well, that's cool part of the song. So I gravitated to those. You'd say like him like that at first, but I mean, you know, James Jamerson, you know, from the Motown thing is like, man, you know, there's that thing of like, hey, I want to play something cool. And then it becomes like, man, I want to play something that feels cool.
Mm-hmm.
Because there becomes that whole thing of like, again, if you want to chalk it up to the girl thing, you know, you play a certain thing like, wow, they're dancing.
Yeah.
You're making that happen. I'm like, okay, I like that. But no, I love the interplay because there's this whole thing. I was telling, somebody was asking me about, you know, how you got into Nashville and country music and you've done a lot of country music, but yet you've done this and that. It's just like, I don't put the pieces together. And I said, well, how did you get into that? And it's like, well, I didn't have a lot of country growing up. In high school, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of, because of where in Florida I grew up, there was country fans and I played some of that, but sonically what grabbed me was listening to you know, Waylon Jennings doing the, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard thing, you know, just a good old boy, you know, and listening to that, listen to the bass and drums on that, it's kind of like thuddy and dead, but man, it's warm and it feels so good, just a solid, you know, right in there. So I really, you know, I was like going, I kind of dig this country sound. You know, it's like the sound of it. It wasn't even just like, because there was, country has this stigma and people don't give it a chance. They automatically think it's like, oh, that's a good old boy, twangy, whatever. I'm like, have you even listened to it? You know,
especially I think a lot of the problem is, like, I saw something on Facebook. I think someone said, you know who Chris Ward is?
I've heard the name.
Phenomenal player, but he had a video on Facebook and guitarist, and underneath Chuck Ward, sorry, I'm having a brain fart. Underneath the video, someone said, man, it's amazing how good country music can sound if you take out the lyrics, take out the vocals, you know, and to some extent that's true, because it's very syrupy at times, and there's a lot of good music going on, and it's hard, you know, it's hard to separate those two when you're hearing the one over the other.
Mm-hmm. And it's very true, and it depends on who it is, you know, yes, because it's a style. Mm-hmm. It's like anything else, and it's authentic to itself. It's also connecting. I mean, country music connects, like, first and foremost, as we say, to people that live in the country. Mm. Well, how do people in the country talk? By nature, you know. So it's kind of like, yeah, he's one of us. You know, it's like there becomes that whole thing of, like, what we talk about, where people identify personally with who they are. Well, I'm a rocker. I'm a jazzer. I'm a this. I'm a that. Because they make the connection not only musically, but they see a personality to it as well. Mm. You know, so there's that. So country music, I think, is that way too. But, man,
that's really interesting what you just said. I never considered it like that, and it makes a lot of sense. But if you put it in that context, for sure.
Well, that's why I think a lot of, you know, not just musicians, but even people that just listen to music in general, they might publicly say, I only listen to this and I don't like this. But if you dig a little deeper, you start to realize, no, you actually do. You just don't fess up to it. Or, you know, or you might, well, I'm not a big country fan. That doesn't mean you don't listen to country. I might, oh, well, I really like, you know, I love Willie Nelson. I love this or whatever. And it's like, oh, you really are a country fan. You just don't think of yourself that way because you know more of the other styles implicitly, or maybe you have a personal connection that, well, when I was growing up, I was hanging out with these guys and that's what we listened to.
Or you don't have that. More likely, I bet, is they don't have that personal connection with the country, like you just said, communication, but they happen to like certain artists about it. So that's why they don't maybe associate it. Because I think that makes that's a ton of sense what you just said. It's how people in the country communicated.
Right, exactly. It's just it's a personality. It's a thing. And honestly, it's like, you know, if I listen to traditional country and I don't hear that kind of a voice, I don't want, you know, I'm like, that's not country. Yeah. To me, it's like, that's part of that, like I was saying, like in the Waylon Jennings song, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard theme, is like sonically what they did, you know, with the banjo doing the slow picking, and then the bass and the drums, just the warmth of that thing. That's a sound. And if you had put anybody else singing that, it just, I wouldn't buy it. You know, I just don't believe, it's not believable. I'm like, but him singing that, I'm like, oh, I totally, not only getting that, but even lyrically what he's singing, I buy it. He's telling a story from his perspective.
Right.
You know, that's just music in general.
Hmm.
You know, it's kind of like they're selling it. You know, it's like even if you go listen to, you know, an opera, a lot of those operas are big tragedies. You know, and singing this over, you know, you think it's overly dramatic or whatever. It's like, well, yeah, they're hurting. They've got their heart ripped out. And I'm like, they're selling it.
Yeah.
If anything else, so
no, it totally makes sense. It's probably a tough one for you because you've been doing this a long time. If you weren't doing what you're doing now, Luis, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
Well, that is a tough question. I don't know what I'd be doing.
Dog trainer.
Well, no, I feel miserably. Yeah, no, Scout's just needy. You know, outside of this. I think it'd still be something artistic. In middle school and high school, I was in like drama club and I loved to act and that was fun. But again, it was one of those things where like I had fun doing it. I had no aspirations to become some big star. You know, it's the same thing of where you have a lot of people that get into music to be stars, not to be musicians.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like, why are you doing this?
That you did get into the, so there was a much more compelling emotional connection for you with music than there was with theater and acting.
Yes. And I think the reason being, again, it wasn't by design. It just the way I naturally developed. I started you know, dabbling in music and taking lessons at an early age right out of the gate. So it's always been a part of me. And music was around the house. Everybody, I know everybody says, well, we had music around the house. Well, yeah, everybody had music around the house, mostly unless you were living in a convent or a monastery. And even then there was music. It was just a different kind of music. But yeah, but the thing is like I got exposed to so many different things right out of the gate. And so there's always, again, that emotional connection was always there with me. So yeah, I mean, music was always just part of my fiber and my being. Hmm. And not because, quote unquote, I was exposed to it or I got the lessons or I did it in school. It just was a sheer desire. It was something I've always wanted to do. And so I think if I had to pick a job, because I've done odd jobs. We've all done odd jobs. Yeah. I worked, those jobs, I worked at music stores. I sold. So those are my day jobs. I worked when I was going to Berkeley. I worked at the Paradise Club as one of the house engineers as a basically a peon for a while, you know, but then like it, almost like an internship through the college. They hooked me with this. And then just because I had a good work ethic that I wasn't going to goof off, like when they had to fire one of the guys, I got hired. So I actually wound up working shows.
That's cool.
So I got paid, I think it was like $8 an hour to throw the monitor wedges out there, wrap the cables, do whatever, be the gopher. But I loved it.
That's just good money back in the day.
And it was back in the day. I was like, man, I'm making $8 an hour. Sweet. Mm. So if I wasn't doing this, I mean, I did other jobs that were still music tied. Maybe another thing I like doing, but this is something I do out of the house I did before, was I kind of like to travel plan. You know, maybe I'd be a travel agent, because when we do vacations, I love getting online and mapping it out and checking it out and, man, let's go do this and let's go see this. Like, you know, I did our honeymoon. I didn't go through a travel agent. I did it myself.
Where'd you get married? Where'd you go on your honeymoon?
Well, we got married in Connecticut up by my wife's family. And then honeymoon, we had to delay our honeymoon. So we got married in May and our honeymoon was in September of that year because of our schedules. Yeah. I was out. She was busy. We went to Whistler, British Columbia.
Oh, cool. Beautiful there. Especially.
You know, beautiful. And like she can ski. She's a big snow skier. I really can't ski for crap. I've done some cross country skiing with her, but not much. But it was that time of year to where it was just more of an outdoorsy thing, like a resort. Go hiking up the mountain, that kind of thing. Zip lining across these big, beautiful gorges. Go horseback riding on these trails through the mountains. So I planned that. So we spent the bulk of it in Whistler. And then we spent the last 3 days of it in Vancouver proper.
Oh, nice.
So we got to go to like the Vancouver. They have a beautiful aquarium there with like one of the things that, and I hooked it up to through like, you know, going online, was we got to do an interactive exhibit with the beluga whales.
Oh, that's cool.
So we got to work with the trainers and give them hand signals and stuff. And they, you know, so they get a treat, you know, and they, you know, we got them to move their blow holes and stuff like that. I know, take that any way you want, but you know, they, it was a good time. So I enjoyed doing that. And to this day, I still like, I finally got to, growing up in Florida, I've been to Disney World a lot and I know Disney World well. So obviously one of my dreams was being a dad, taking my family to Disney World.
Oh,
and
you got to do that, I'm sure, right?
I did it this year for the first time in May.
Cool.
So
did your oldest daughter come with you as well?
She did not come this time around. She had stuff, so she wasn't able to come, but I took the two boys and my wife and I.
Cool.
And even planned it, just the planning. I booked all the tickets. Mm. I actually met them, and they flew down. I had a gig down in Florida with Trace. We were playing in Okeechobee, I think, right off of Lake Okeechobee. And so I planned it to where the bus dropped me off the nearest exit. I took an Uber to the resort and met him there.
Ah, that's cool, man.
So I, you know, I love doing that. That's kind of fun for me. But really, I mean, and honestly, this has been my wants and desire, you know, it's just music. And I'm lucky enough to get to do that at this level. I'm very fortunate.
It's funny about Trace. After he was on The Apprentice, we were up in New York, like right after the show ended, and we went to the, my aunt and I, and we took the three kids with us. I think this time we were all at the museum, the Museum of Natural History, and walk in there and see freaking Trace Atkins walking around. It was really funny, man. And in New York, nobody bothers you. Funny enough, like, and I've heard many celebrities say that he was just walking around with his kids. It's like we were, you know, nothing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy. It's interesting because out of all the famous artists I've worked with that have that kind of visible notoriety, that know, that will know you visually right out of the gate. And like, you know, Trace
Oh, the hat, and he's really tall. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't wear, obviously in public, he won't wear a hat. You know, he'll put on a ball cap and that'll be about it. But he's still a big dude. You know, he's still a tall dude and recognizable still. So, but he's good about it. He's just kind of, if it happens, it happens. What can you do? He's like, I'm not going to let that, as he says, he's not going to let it prevent him from living his life.
Yeah.
Well, so like even the other day, like we were out finishing up a run and he had left on he took the runner and went somewhere. And I was curious where he went. He went to Home Depot. He's like, oh, I was wanting to look at some stuff. And sure enough, like they, you know, one of the manager guys like, man, we should put more content on your social media. So can we film you going to Home Depot? And he's like, yeah, if you want. Looking at 2x4s, if you think that's worthy of putting in content. But sure enough, I watch and he's just kind of just hanging out at Home Depot like any other dude. And, you know, he's that guy. You know, yeah. And also it's great because he's a golfer. So one of the things I get to do, and I'll golf occasionally. I'm not that good. Or Trace will even say none of us are good, but we still have fun. But because of Trace and being able to golf, he's able to use that to go. I've got to golf at some really exclusive places.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's like I have no business being there, but here I am, you know, playing golf. You know, we played there's a place in Ohio, I think it is, in upstate Ohio called Inverness. Mm-hmm. It's a super exclusive, like top-rated club. That everybody, all the guys in the band will tell me, oh, dude, you're going to love this club. But, you know, you have to have a caddy. You have to, you know, it's literally, I'm like, I am living the old rich man's dream. I've got a dude carrying my clubs. I get to do nothing. And a dude finding my balls for me. Like, he runs out there and he just goes,
serious.
There's your ball. And then I get up there and he's like, you might want to use an 8-iron on this shot. And I mean, it was great. It was just like, and that's because Trace hooked it up. You know, it's really cool of him to do
too.
That's
very cool of him to do that.
Thanks, man.
That's very nice, man.
And the other good thing about that gig is he's the kind of guy where he's not worried about all the superficial stuff. He wants you to be the best player. He's like, I'm hiring you because of the way you play. Don't forget it. You know, like you know,
he doesn't micromanage or anything like that.
No, he's the kind of guy who's like, no, I just want it to be right. So he, you know, his whole thing is like he hires the players for their skill set and for their work ethic. He's like, just bring your A game every night. You know, obviously look like you're supposed to be on stage. It's a given, but nobody worries about that. They just put on what's appropriate. But please, please, please bring your A game.
That's awesome.
You know,
tell me something about yourself. People will either be surprised to hear or find a little odd.
Again, a tough question.
That's probably something I would say, a tough question. And I know if you said it to my wife, she'd be like, want a list?
Yeah, my wife would probably be the same
thing. I'm just
thing.
Hearing I think that actually, in the back of my head.
I think my wife said something to the degree of like, you know, especially that question, she said something to the degree of like, well, I mean, you're fluent in Spanish. I said, yeah, but a lot of people kind of, if they get to know me, either assume or ask if I do. So that's kind of an interesting thing. I've played salsa music before, even though I haven't done that in a while. But I've done that at a regular clip years ago here in town.
It's not really odd, Luis. We need it odd.
Yeah, that's not odd. And I'm a bass player, and a lot of people see me electric bass strapped around me. But I play upright bass. I play keyboard bass. I basically I give you bass of whatever bass you need. I'm trying to think of something odd. I don't know what's odd. I'm odd, I guess. I mean,
All right, we'll have to table this question till the next time.
Yeah, maybe so.
I need a real odd answer here.
I got to think about that one.
What's the happiest moment or time in your life?
Probably now. That's there's many happy moments in my life. I can't really pinpoint of a specific time. Because I've got great childhood memories. I've got great college memories. I've got great now memories. I've got great memories from 10 years ago. You know, my wife and I both talk about like, you know, where both of us were dirt poor. So relatively speaking, you know, where we're not, you know, we're doing the ramen thing because she's in school and not making any money at all. I'm scraping together what gigs I can.
Sure.
You know, but we still had happy times because when we first moved in together, we had an apartment together, but there was a tennis court at the apartment complex and we're like, well, really, I mean, we could go to the movies, that'll blow whatever cash we have. So let's just go play tennis and then we'll come home and watch TV. she talked about how those were happy times too.
Sure, man. I mean, so connecting with someone special, that's really happy.
I never pictured myself, you know, in the grand scheme of things with being a parent. I never would poo-poo it. I'm like, well, to me, my approach is if it happens, it happens. Hmm. But it's not like a big life accomplishment. But now that I am a parent, I'm glad I am. Because I got to, because otherwise I'd be like, well, at least in life, I'm like, well, I got to do that too.
Sure.
You know, and you're a father, you know how that is. It's like there's that old saying of you don't get it until you have kids of your own. That is true.
Yeah, sure.
To a certain degree, you can appreciate it, but then you kind of get it. So, you know, my kids are not only just a source of encouragement and keeping me level, but they're a source of entertainment. You know, they crack me up and apparently I crack them up too. I don't know what, my two older kids who are fluent in Mandarin, I knew a few words, but like I say something that I think is pronounced correctly and they start, and they're like, no, I said it right. Didn't I? No, you said this. I'm like, that's what I said. No, you didn't. Damn it. You know, that kind of thing. Sure. Or my precocious 3.5-year-old who's now has learned to communicate effectively, but is now very opinionated. No, Baba, that's not how you do it. I got a 3-year-old busting my chops. Wow. You know,
that could be your kid. That could be the one that sets you over the edge, man.
Oh, I'm sure that might be the one because he's pretty precocious. But then again, you know, all my kids, there's something that surprises me every day. Like it floors me, like, wow, you're pretty smart. You know, that moment where you realize, like, wow, you've got your own sense of self, and it just blows you away. You know, going like, well, yeah, that's developmentally correct, but still, you're like, wow, it's my kid who's like has an opinion, is growing up and doing all these grown up things.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. So yeah, happiest time of my life. There's been many. Now, then, it's all happening.
Most important person in your life and why?
That varies because I'll tell you why. There's many people that have been so important to me in my life throughout different parts, because obviously I could say who's the most musically important person in my life, who's the most personally important person in my life, because those are all aspects of who I am.
Sure.
So, I mean, I could say like from early on, a lot of my dad obviously was super important, my family in general, but really as far as, you know, as you imagine, you know, kind of giving you that common sense and that steering you into, you know, good moral judgment, good common practices that just to get through life, my dad definitely did. And even putting the music bug in me as well, too.
Yeah,
my dad on that one. And then musically speaking, you know, I've had so many great teachers that have been mentors to me throughout the years, starting all the way back to, you know, middle school, high school, college, and even beyond. And then, you know, coming to Nashville and getting some, you know, some great words of wisdom from some of the guys here, the old pros. And then personally, obviously, my wife and my kids, my family, that's all super important because it sounds cliche, but they keep you grounded.
Sure. No, it sounds appropriate. Yeah.
You know, it really does. But I mean, that's true because I'd be amiss to pinpoint just one person because, yeah, it's one person, but that's only one sliver of who I am. You know, they're the best influence on this part of me, but then there's all these other parts that make me me.
Yeah, I totally get that, man. What's your non-musical superpower? I love this question. It's always so interesting. I hear lots of funny things.
My non-musical superpower, probably I'm pretty good at organizing stuff. I'm balancing the checkbook around here. I'm a good whiz at certain things, but even beyond that, which translate, I got some pretty good computer skills, so I can steer my way around, you know, Pro Tools fairly well. And the same breath, I have on the other screen like my finance program, and I'll be, you know, balancing the books at the same time. So I guess probably organization skills. You know, that's my superpower outside of music, but it tails into that as well.
Oh, you know, I'll tell you a funny answer with the odd question when I asked Nomad, Michael Rapole.
Yeah.
He likes doing dishes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I wasn't expecting that out of him. It was funny.
I wouldn't be either. That's cool.
Yeah, that was very odd. Yeah. any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Again, tough one because they kind of, even my hobbies, you know, music is such a passion thing that it becomes your all encompassing thing, including hobbies. Mm. But it, I mean, other hobbies really, other than, like I said before, like planning our vacations, that's almost like a hobby to me. I like doing that, is really just doing things with the family. Like even, you know, I'm a big movie buff. I like watching movies and watching stuff with my wife at home, but also going out to see stuff and that kind of thing. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else like hobby wise that I do that's not musically related. Of course, I'll probably think of something after the fact, but right now that's hard to say, because even my hobbies, like where people would normally have downtime and maybe, you know, go to their wood shop or something like that, I'm here tweaking things and working music, you know, some other musical things, whether it's, you know, diddling around with an analog synth or trying a new bass or trying something new within Pro Tools or what have you not. That's almost like a hobby. Hmm. But all that stuff I don't call a hobby, because then I incorporate those things into my professional life.
Yeah. It's hard for musicians to have hobbies. I have a lot of guys do, but the most part it's tough.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to this question, the next two questions, because well, I'll tell you afterwards. If you can go back and do one thing different, either business or personally, what would that one thing be?
That I would do different. Normally different has a negative connotation to it, meaning like, you know, you do it differently because you did it wrong the first time. The only thing I would say probably in that sense is maybe one thing I'd do different is probably take more chances. There's a lot of times, especially when I moved to town, and obviously getting day jobs before being able to move to this full time, is I didn't just jump off the ship, so to speak, like AKA quit a day job just because there was an opportunity. Because the opportunity, I'm like, I started waiting. It's like, well, it's three gigs and then the gigs are over. It might lead to something else. In a lot of cases has, but I didn't jump ship to go do them. AKA I didn't quit a job to go do it. I might, and I did do that eventually, but I probably would have done that sooner. I actually, one of the first things I quit working at the music store here in town, I quit that to do a gig because, and it was an independent artist, but the artist had financing to kind of pay us weekly. So kind of a salary.
So you're on salary for a bit.
Right. Yeah. Now, granted, you know, and it's one of those things where like it was just good enough. I was like, and that was the thing. They were kind of asking like, well, what do you need to pay your bills? And they were kind of, you know, figuring out to try to make it work for everybody. And I finally said, well, it's something that's somewhat steady. I better go give it a shot. And I did. The gig lasted a month.
Oh, you know, wow.
Because, and I'm still friends with the artist. The artist actually is, it's a guy by the name of Todd Cooper. Super talented cat. And he used to work with like a big Christian artist, Michael W. Smith, back in the day. And he, at that time, it wasn't that I was fired or he quit, is that he was going to move to New York. And he did. And he's even said to us, he's like, anybody that wants to come with me, let's go. We can go to New York and make a go out of it. And it was kind of a band, but not. It was really built under his name. So it was like being a hired gun. And obviously, I had my girlfriend now, wife, already established in a relationship with her. I had other gigs I was doing. And subsequently, nobody in the band went with him. Actually, the drummer did go with him, but came back pretty quickly. Because then the guitar player and the drummer actually wound up becoming the main guitar player and drummer for Big and Rich.
Oh, so right, interesting.
So they, right when Big and Rich started to get big, so they got into a steady gig. So the artist now, and he did move back to Nashville.
Was that Adam? Or no, that was before.
It was Adam Schoenfeld.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Adam was in that band. He'll tell you about it. Yeah, yeah. Todd Cooper, is Larry Babb and Adam Schoenfeld.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was Adam, and Adam jumped in because he came back and they started to do basically that band. They did a band called Lovejoy.
Right. It was right. Tell me about
Craig,
that.
Yeah. And right. That was Big Kenny. And that was right. That happened right after what I did with him and Todd Cooper. Mm. Todd did move back to town. Todd now plays for the Alan Parsons Project.
Wow.
Or they, I don't know if they call it the Alan Parsons Project. They call it the Alan Parsons Live Project. Because it's Alan Parsons with the band.
Right, right.
But the project was two guys.
Every time I hear, you know, I love Alan Parsons' music and, you know, obviously his work with Pink Floyd and stuff. But every time I hear Alan Parsons, I think of Austin Powers.
Oh, the Alan Parsons.
Yeah, yeah. That was just, that line was just hilarious. You know, it very juvenile guy kind of humor. But
oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure, like, I got to meet Alan once a couple of years back in Vegas because I have two of my buddies who play with him now, and Todd being one of them. So obviously I went to the show and they introduced me to Alan, which is cool, but I had that in the back of my head. I'll just say you that. But I got overshadowed with the fact of like, oh yeah, you worked with the Beatles and Pink Floyd, and yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. People don't realize that he worked on Dark Side of the Moon like that.
Yeah, he's the engineer and a lot of that creative stuff. I mean, especially that album, which is known for being that kind of spatially, you know, so many studio tricks that add to the record was him.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. So it just kind of floors you.
So you take more chances, is the bottom line.
So yes, that's the answer to the question. Is probably take more chance. Do more. Take as many. I mean, I took all the gigs I could do, but I would do even more so because I said no to some of those because like it would involve me quitting my day job, my source of income.
Gotcha.
And I did do that eventually, but I didn't do it. I could have done that sooner.
Yeah, it's tough because that's one of those things where you're choosing a certain course because of your sense of responsibility.
Right.
You know, because I'm sure you weren't thinking about yourself only. You're probably thinking about yourself and your girlfriend at the time.
Right. And that's true also. But I mean, really, and this is going to sound shallow, but even more so, I was thinking about like how am I going to pay the rent? End of story.
No, that's not shallow. It's like reality. What are you going to do? If you'd be an idiot not to think about that, you know, that is unfortunately a prime consideration, you know, of living, you know, how am I going to pay the rent?
Exactly. So
this is another one I'd be curious. Toughest decision you ever had to make, or hardest thing you ever had to do, besides deal with your dog during this interview?
Yeah, good Lord. I'm so sorry about that. Yeah,
no, it's totally cool, man. I am
one of those days, I guess.
No, it's totally cool. Stuff happens, man.
The toughest thing I've ever repeat the question one more time, just so I have in
context. Toughest decision you ever had to make, or the hardest thing you ever had to do?
Well, and some people would say it's not the toughest thing or the hardest decision, but it definitely was one that required thought, and I really had to kind of jump in feet first. But it goes back to what I was saying earlier about quitting a job. I got one of the last day jobs I had was tied into working with music stores. I wound up doing wholesale sales. So I was like a sales rep for some of these companies like Alesis, AKG, Hosa, Middle Atlantic, some of these music companies. And so I moved the next step up, which involves a bigger paycheck, health insurance, a company car, a company cell phone, you know, all these things that like, oh, this is nice. It was the same thing. Like, I know you spoke to Chris Nix where he worked with Line 6. You know, it's kind of a similar situation. And I was asked early on because my boss was super nice. And he says, look, the days that you have to gig, we'll just pay you on the day rate. So just tell me ahead. Like this week, you're taking off because you're doing a gig on Wednesday. Okay, cool.
Wow. And then you
days. So obviously he says, well, I need you for some specific stuff for sure. But then outside of that, then we can work it. So he's super cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
They still paid very well. They took good care of us. And my first thing I did with that company was I went to Winter NAMM, went to LA. And that was like me starting was right into the fire, right into the trade show. And the other guys at the company were having dinner that night. And they're like, just do me a favor. Don't quit us just for any other road gig or whatever. And I said, all right, I'll make you a promise. I won't quit unless it's like a high grade gig, like a, you know, like a Tim McGraw or a Garth Brooks or something that's going to be like arena stadium level with a salary, or I get a major record deal or something like that. So a year and a half later, I got signed to Atlantic Records.
And
I told them, I said, hey, you know, and so I had to mull that one over because I knew what was going to be involved. And that was a hard decision. Like I knew what I had to do, what I wanted to do in my heart, but to actually go through it was very tough to actually, okay, man up, get in there and say, I'm quitting and here's why. And that was a learning experience. I was relieved when I did, and I was happy that I did it. And it was no fault of theirs or anything else, but it was the, hey, remember when I told you I wouldn't quit unless, well, I got to do whatever. And you know, the boss man was like, well, yeah, you got to do that. And it was cool because the first thing we did is we hopped into Oceanway here in Nashville, the major studio, to record the album. And he came by to see it, you know. I'm like, yeah, come in. I'll, you know, because he's never been in Oceanway. So I gave him the tour of Oceanway. He saw us tracking a bit. And he's an engineer guy, so he knew the gear. So he was just happy to see it. So that was probably the toughest thing, to finally let go of that safety net. Because there was, with that record deal, there was a little bit of an advance to live off of, but not, you know, this is already, you know, the new millennium. There was not the money you heard about back in the day where we're going to give you a $2 million advance. No, that didn't exist already. That was already gone. So I was really letting go of a safety net. And there was the uncertainty. We don't know how this is going to go.
Right.
But I'm glad I did it.
Good.
So it was just tough.
And that was with Hot Action Cop when you got signed.
That was correct. That was with Hot Action. Yeah.
Two more questions, Luis.
Sure.
What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Again, a tough one. I've gotten a lot of advice for you. It's great. There's one that comes to mind, and it was right when I moved to town. When I was working at the music store, Victor Wooten came in frequently because he's a Nashville guy, and he's a super nice guy.
He lives in Nashville?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a longtime Nashville resident. And he's that guy that everybody makes him up to be. Like, he's a brilliant musician, but he has that emotional and mindset. Like, he's at peace and at one with everything. Like, if you talk to the guy, it's just like you feel better already. You just talk to him like, man, life's not that bad. You know, he's like, it's all good.
Do you know Mike Brignadello?
Oh, yeah. I know Mike. Mike was my predecessor in the Trace Atkins gig.
Okay.
So, because he played on Trace's records.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, Mike played on a lot of the Trace stuff. Not all of it, but he played on the bulk of that stuff. And for a while there, Mike was doing the gig live.
His resume of the prominent artists he's played with is like nuts.
But
he knows Victor really well, and he told me he just had nothing but high praises for what a cool human being he was.
Oh, dude, he's the best. I mean, everybody knows his technical prowess, but even beyond the chop stuff, if you listen to what he's doing musically, he knows to communicate that language. It might seem like a lot of fast notes to people, like, oh, he's just doing trickery. But if you really get in the context of what he's doing, he's like, no, he's got it. You know, he understands the language. But what he said to me, the best advice was, he came into the store and I'd met him once before, I think. So this is the second time I've seen him. And obviously it was just a quick, hi, how are you? Blah, blah, blah. Love what you do. He picked up, I had a couple of times where I was, kind of down, shall we say. I was in the gig and I wasn't, you know, I didn't want a day job. I just wanted, you know, I didn't have a lot of playing work because I was new to town. Nobody knew me. So he must have picked up on it. He had a sense about it. He kind of gave me the, hey, what's wrong? Kind of like, what's up? And I felt compelled to tell him. I was like, man, you know, I'm just here trying to do my due. It's just tough, you know, trying to get more gigs, whatever. And he kind of gave me that very insightful, almost professorial look. And he kind of just said, well, let me ask you something. I'm like, okay. He's like, why are you doing this? I said, well, I love to play music. He's like, stop. He's like, you just said it right there. Always, he said, keep that in mind. Always, 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 because that's what's going to get you through the good and the bad. And he used himself as an example. He's like, I've been playing with Belafleck and the Fleck Tones for 15 years at that point, I think, or whatever. He's like, I'm just now seeing what most people consider decent money. He's like, and that put it in perspective, because here's this world-renowned player.
Yeah.
You would assume he's a millionaire, and he's like, no, far from it. He's like, I'm now making a good living, I can say that, but not what you think. He says, you cannot lose sight of why are you doing this? Because, and that's carried me. It really has. Even go like, man, I still love what I do, you know? And all of a sudden, like, it was just like this big relief. This big weight was lifted off.
Yeah. I could see. Yeah. I would understand that.
It's like the light bulb moment. It was the, oh, why are you doing this? Like, he's like, think about why you're doing this. Really, what got you into this? Did you really start it because you're like, well, if I work, this paycheck will be blah, blah, blah. No. He's like, you did it because you love making music. And also it's like, boom, and it worked.
Well, also what it did was it put it back in your court that, hey, man, this is a choice. You don't have to make this choice. And so it's an empowering feeling as opposed to a victim feeling, which you're probably feeling earlier.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And he said it. He's like, look, it's going to, you know, things ebb and flow for all musicians. You know, even if they're quote unquote famous or whatever, well known or successful, It ebbs and flows. You just have to like not lose sight of that, because that's what's going to keep you sane and keep you doing it and give you the energy to persevere, to persist. Because you have to just keep going, you know?
Interesting. Last question, man. And this changes all the time. What's your definition of happiness?
Again, that's a tough one as well, for the same reason that there's so many different answers to it, the way I see it. Well, in a very simple sense, the definition of happiness differs from person to person. My definition of happiness is what makes me happy is having a well-balanced life. It's obviously doing what you love to do, not only professionally, but personally. So, you know, I love doing the family thing. So there's my personal thing. I love being married to my wife. I love having the kids. I love having the dog, even, you know.
Sure.
As much as all the above can be pain in the butts, you know, including myself.
Sure.
I love having it. I love being able to do what I do. I'm proud of being a musician, of what I do, not just because there's some sort of notoriety involved with it and it's the cool job to have. It's just who I am. I even had a band director in middle school instill that in me even early on, because, you know, he always said, be proud of, you know, being a musician or being in band. Because a lot of people will get teased at their early age if you're carrying around an instrument.
Oh, especially a big bass like that. Yeah.
And even then, I wasn't carrying a bass, because even then I was a trumpet player in middle school.
Oh, okay.
But whatever it was, it didn't matter. You might get teased about it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, band, you know, the band geek thing or whatever. Yeah. But he even flat out said, he's like, you know, be like that kid who's like, you know, hey, are you in band or something? And the guy held up his instrument and said, yes, I am. You know, as corny as that sounds, there really is a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, but if it resonated with you at the right time, it's a great message.
Absolutely, it resonated. And it still resonates, you know, to this day with me, where, you know, I might occasionally in jest and joke and go like, yeah, I'm a bass player. But really, I'm very proud of what I do. And even when people don't understand what that means, because I have a lot of people who are outside of Nashville that have nothing to do with the music industry don't fully understand what's involved in my job and the business at large. And me trying to explain it to people is a daunting task.
Yeah.
People just have a hard time because it's not very black and white. So for people to wrap their heads around it is very, very tricky.
Man, I appreciate everything. I really appreciate how gracious you've been with your time, Luis. And in light of the hardship on your lap there.
My dog is on my lap right now. Yeah, it's the only way to shut him up for right now. Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's just today he's just needy, but whatever.
It's sometimes all good, man. It's you know, and I'll tell you what, the microphone, whatever microphone on your desk, it must be an expensive as hell mic, because every time, and you got to be, I mean, it looks like you're 2.5-3 feet away.
Mm-hmm. About 3.5.
Okay, 3.5 feet. Every lick that dog did.
Sorry.
No. It's crisp. It's very background. It's like shuffling a paper. It was not. It's not like writing. It's not like, you know, like that. It was like way in the background. But like I was like fascinated. Like, holy crap, this has got to be like $1,000 microphone or something. I was like,
well, I'll tell you what it is. It's an Audio Technica condenser mic, and it's the mic that I use to record upright with at home.
Okay, it's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. It's my main specifically for that purpose. And that's the reason I have it. I might get another one too, just to have a different flavor. But this is the mic that I primarily use because I do tracks out of the house, including upright. So upright specifically, I use this. And because of that clarity.
It's amazing, man. I mean, I was like, wow. Anyway, speaking of tracks, let's tell people how they could find you, man. First of all, it's Luis Espaillat. It's Luis Espaillat. And let me tell you where you could find Luis, a bunch of different places. You could find him. First of all, he's got a band that he's got a trio now, a rock trio that he's part of. So check them out. What's that?
I was going to say, it's actually it is a trio by nature, but we're playing as a quartet.
Sorry, man. I apologize.
No worries, dude. It's all good.
He's got a quartet that he's... No editing on this show. He's got a quartet, Dixie Horsepower. They're a rock band, and it's Luis, and it's actually the drummer from Tesla, if I'm correct.
Troy Liketta, correct.
And two other guys that they've played with for a while, but it's a cool rock band, and it's called Dixie Horsepower. And you can check them out on Spotify and on iTunes, and you can also go to facebook.com/Dixie Horsepower. Hit them up on Facebook if you want a t-shirt. Come out and see him play. You could also check him out on his website, which is Luis Espaillat, LuisEspaillat.com. He does bass tracks at home, and he didn't just jump on the tracks, you know, kind of gig. He's been doing tracks for 10 years. He's got a really cool studio at home, and it's well used and well versatile, and he's a master when it comes to Pro Tools. So check him out online and, you know, send him some money because he's a good guy. You can find him on Twitter at twitter.com/LuisBass, LuisBass, on youtube.com at LuisEspaillat, and on instagram.com at EBassLuis, EBassLuis. Did I miss anything?
Man, I think you got it all. Did you get Instagram in there too?
I think I did. EBass, yeah. Right? EBass, yeah. I'll say it again. Instagram is at EBassLuis, EBassLuis. And his next job will be placating advanced age dogs. That's plan B here. Anyway, check him out. He's an excellent bass player, and he's a really sweet guy, as you can hear. And I really appreciate all your time you gave me, man. Thank you so much. It means a lot.
Great. Thanks so much. Appreciate you.
Check out Luis. I appreciate you listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again, Luis, for everything. And you guys go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some cool stuff for guitar players. Be nice, go play a guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.